Hello everyone, my name is Marlies van Hauck. I'm happy to meet you and the well-beings this afternoon. We're in good company. Thank you, Valentina, for your beautiful work. Thanks so much to you and Seda for co-curating this series and for inviting me to read from my writing. I would also like to thank the Museum für Kunst und Gewerbe for hosting the exhibition and the public program, as well as the Hochschule für Bildende Künste. Seda and I met in Rotterdam when she was in town to host a workshop and present her latest book at a local space for artist publishing, Print Room, where I worked at the time. The conversation with Seda about editing and activating archives and about making things public was one of those unexpected encounters that resonated with me and that led to us sharing a moment here today. In response to Seda's invitation, my reading will tune in to experiences with attentive listening and encounters with water. It will explore the porous lines between lived experience and language, and between personal memories and critical reflections. What I will be reading today is a collection of words, of meandering lines that sometimes dip and dive, then surface again, to leak into a next pool of thoughts. I would like to take Seda's and Valentina's invitation to me to do a public reading of words and pass it on to you to respond in a language of your choice. This means that after the reading and listening, there will be time to reflect in silence, through gestures, or in dialogue. If you feel like responding in writing, we invite you to use the paper cards and leave some words. They're on this little table. For now, please make yourself comfortable. Yeah, it's on. Part one. Recently, I moved to Utrecht in the Netherlands. To be honest, I had not expected to live in a city without a river again. Being close to water seemed one of those basic needs for years now. Flowing rivers calm me down. They make me feel connected as a body of water to other bodies of water. It might be my zodiac sign, Pisces. Utrecht is not built on the banks of a river. But bodies of water are everywhere. Around the corner of my apartment block, which is located in the Poets Quarter, is a human-made canal. It leads to a small historical port where vegetables were once brought in and traded. On site, one can find some remains of industrial heritage, by now renovated, and the outcome of a recent restoration project. It's the remodeling of a wooden ship from 1746. The original used to sail the rich across the seas. I have passed this reconstructed Dutch Admiralty Yard a couple of times during my strolls through the borough. I'm tempted to learn more of its history someday. Interestingly, the recent building of the replica was an employment opportunity for people with limited access to the labor market. Part two. In a bi-weekly letter exchange, which we named River Stories, London-based cultural geographer Olivia Sheringham and I engage in an ongoing conversation about the fluvial, or, in other words, about all things river. The fluvial may refer to fluidity and movement. It may also refer to notions of filtrations and getting stuck. As conversation partners, we are interested in the porous boundaries of language, in what we cannot immediately understand with words, but which might dare us all the same to be attentive to different modes of storytelling and world-making. The correspondence is a space where ideas of the not yet known the messy, and the relational can be explored. We ask ourselves how to move beyond our usual medium of text in the process of making things public, and how to actively challenge our positions as writers. These positions, like texts and rivers, are never neutral. Some of this is inspired by hydrofeminism, a mode of thought that considers the human body, which is mostly made up of water, as equal and not privileged to other natural bodies of water. Water connects all entities. How can we think with water? And how can we listen to it? What can we learn from watery encounters, watery commons, fluidity, and porous borders? How does silence relate to storytelling? Olivia and I share a reading journal with notes and music on thought-provoking texts. We draw inspiration from deep listening, decolonial theory, queer phenomenology, and artistic and ethnographic work on belonging, memory, migration, and care, to name a few. To physically encounter rivers, lakes, marshes, or oceans, we turn to listening exercises. Part 3, Tuesday, February 8. Dear Olivia, thank you so much for your reflections. I truly enjoyed reading them, since your research experience and work as a geographer leads to interesting perspectives, especially for someone who is less familiar with politics of migration. I really like how you arrive at the point, via sites of violence, that the unpredictability of water could bring hope and ways of resistance within, despite, and against certain infrastructures. Thank you for sharing this idea, and for sharing the article Wading into Research, Thinking with and in the River Kwagi, written by two British geographers. The researchers asked several participants who are engaged in monitoring the urban river and caring for it, or who live nearby, to select a favorite location for an interview. This meant not only talking about the river, but also wading into it. The researchers, as academics, ask what water does to their research. I was particularly inspired by the way they illustrate their encounters with the Kwagi and with locals, with their stories and memories. They quite strikingly and honestly describe the limitations of their academic work, of interviewing as a method, and of putting things in words. It reminds them of their ethical commitments, their position as researchers, and what it means to ask others to articulate their thoughts. The researchers actually stated that they might not have the right to ask. There is something to be said for the misty and muddy here, and for the opaque. When I opened the virtual map that traces the project's audio recordings along the River Kwagi, I stumbled into a conversation about the river and its boundaries. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about boundaries, about what they do, and how they relate to water. There is a sentence in an article by Elvia Wilk, it's titled This Compass, The Erotics of Rot, that has stuck with me for quite a while now, and I quote, "Only when a boundary materializes can it become a site for transgression," end of quote. A river needs banks to flow, porous as they might be. Black feminist author Alexis Pauline Gums writes about marine mammals and echolocation. The mammals send their sounds to bounds of something, to be able to navigate the oceans. In her book, Undrowning, Alexis Pauline Gums voices the need for banks as spaces of rest and of support amidst flow. She asks how generative boundaries differ from destructive borders. Sound, like water, needs membranes to resonate or banks to collide against. To listen deeply, we cannot do without the membranes in our ears. I wonder, what can a practice of bouncing sounds teach us about our situatedness in the depths and surfaces of this world? Can we think of boundaries and borders as sites of possibility, as well as restriction and control, in interaction with the fluvial and the watery? And should we? I would like to conclude this week's letter with this morning's deep listening exercise I chose to perform. It is part of the collection of listening exercises developed by artist Martine van Lubeek. Its title is Hearing Water, and it goes like this. Hearing water. Go stand, sit or kneel down close to a river. Start to listen to the soundscape surrounding you. Now slowly zoom in on the sound of the water. The way the water crashes against rocks. The way the water softly touches plants. The way the water moves the sand. Listen attentively to each single sound, each single note the water produces, and slowly zoom out again to be able to hear the whole symphony of watery sounds. During this exercise, I myself was seated on a small rock at a sandy patch at the River Waal in Nijmegen, the Netherlands, not far from the city's historic harbor. The water level was higher than it usually is. There was not much left of the beach. Clear sky, sunny, cold. The initial soundscape is a mixture of traffic, crossing the bridge above me to the right, a few birds flying overhead, a woman approaching calling her dog, the dog jumping in the water next to where I sit, the engine of a barge passing downstream. Listening closer, I hear the river hitting the shore, first to my right, upstream, then to my left, downstream. The sound is an easy rolling of water, a louder crashing of waves, sometimes a roaring in the distance, where ships pass the groins. The waters rumbling, plunging. Looking up, I let my eyes rest on the words that are painted on the bridge years ago. It says, "Refugees welcome." These words make me wonder again about streams, infrastructures, and borders. Part 4. A recent issue of Simulacrum, a magazine for arts and culture in the Netherlands, was dedicated to water. Mateo Vargas, a non-binary Mexican filmmaker and visual artist, contributed a text titled Black Waters, the Flow of History. Mateo Vargas' multimedia work centers on historical intersections of identity, land, and diaspora. In the article, they talk about the Cuatitlán River their grandmother used to bathe in and drink from as a child. Back then, it provided the local community with fresh fish and irrigation for farming. Nowadays, its toxicity is a real danger to human and non-human life. As an artist, Vargas aims to examine ways to question neoliberalism and capitalism's role in the climate crisis, and how the crisis affects communities in the global south. In addition, Vargas is interested in the loss of language and of oral histories his grandmother grew up with. In documenting the river and documenting stories of family members who sometimes interview each other, they let the water speak. And I quote, "I attempted to transform my singular voice into a communal reconstruction of collective memory." End quote. The short documentary Aguas Negras from 2021 is the artist's account of the river's duality. It's both a site of life and a site of death. It is disturbing to learn about the Mexican waters of criminalization and war, and of all the mourning. But this artistic practice is also an example of collective work, of the agency beyond the eye. I sometimes wonder, or worry, that my work lacks action. A major part of my practice as an editor, writer, and program developer is text-based. How can I turn my words into action without taking center stage? How can I do so as a white person who identifies as a woman and as a human amongst the more than human on this bruised planet? From the point of view of an editor, one way to take responsibility is to take on the role of critical friend to artists and scholars. Supporting their practice, for instance through researching, editing, teaching or curating, is a means to carry forward the necessary work of unlearning and relearning certain scenarios anew. How can we hold space for lived experiences and struggles, such as the artist's grandmother's relation to the river? And how can we counter fossilized systems of oppression and prevailing narratives of neglect? It is through major environmental disasters, such as the recent earthquakes that impacted the lives of many Turkish, Syrian, and Kurdish people and animals, that failures of politics and policies are brought to light. In the painful exposure of precarious conditions overseas or nearby, we sometimes forget how all of us are complicit and how every one of us has the potential to practice acts of care. Part 5, Monday, January 23. Dear Olivia, last Friday, someone shared the article Blue History with me, written by Jessica Lehmann and published in The New Inquiry. Have you read it, maybe? I really liked how the author refers to the Ocean Archive, and I quote, "The Ocean Archive is a record of life on Earth, formed and filtered through marine dynamics and only available to us in partial and unpredictable ways." End quote. She compares the Ocean Archive to the traditional archive, which, according to her, stops and isolates history, periodizes and indexes the past, and sits in a building, often with limited access. The author ends the article with the following, my apologies for a spoiler. "We must understand that we are all eventual material for the Ocean Archive. Our bodies, our actions, our infrastructures. The Ocean Archive catalogues the different ways we have been laid to waste and have wasted, moving our material in planetary dynamics that might memorialize and reshuffle inequalities, yet unevenly and without stable utopian promise." When I recently came across this letter to Olivia again, a wave of thoughts was set in motion. It reminded me of the idea that both archives and interpretations of archives are situated in continuous flux and full of voids. The position of the researcher or the artist that engages with archives is not fixed or stable either. We are equally in flux and affected by context and matter. Our part as humans should be a humble one to play, but often we are still acting as if we have been granted the position as protagonist, the main character of the story. Archives tend to be leaky, like memory. Can be a blessing as well as a curse. Archives are a potential polyphony of stories and relations, while subject to colonization at the same time. How can we, then, critically question time, linearity, heritage, and hegemony when we encounter archival matter, like texts and stories, for instance, but also oceans, soil, and land? One thing that I keep returning to is the idea that archives are never neutral. The same goes for bodies of water, yours, mine, the rivers. In my reading journal, I found a quote by Astrida Naimanis, a leading scholar in hydrofeminism. Naimanis writes that, and I quote, "The waters that we comprise are never neutral. Their flows are directed by intensities of power and empowerment. Currents of water are also currents of toxicity, of queerness, coloniality, sexual difference, global capitalism, imagination, desire, and multi-species community." Naimanis also states that humans are leaving a planetary mark that will be clearly legible in the planetary archive of the future. The ocean, its currents, and soil have a capacity to remember that reaches far beyond an individual's. This is something that we tend to forget. Part 6. I remember participating in another deep listening session, together with a small group of students. The session was led by Martine van Lubeek, who designed the collection of listening exercises, of which Hearing Water, which I described earlier, was one. This particular session took place at the windy banks of a large pond in an urban park, both a fixed geographical location on the map and a watery site. It was raining. According to van Lubeek, our listening expands as soon as we start recognizing that dripping differs from dribbling, leaking from seeping, and sprinkling from spraying. These are her words. Deep listening is a way to create intimacy and to make kin in this world. It requires time and practice. For this exercise, we stood in a circle and we were watched carefully and curiously by a flock of geese. After warming up our shivering limbs through moving and breathing exercises, guided by Martine, we entered a collective space of attentive listening. Listening with, through, and as bodies of water. We were invited to close our eyes and to envision the inhaling and exhaling of hydro particles. To tune in to internal noises and let external sounds enter our ears. In relative silence, we were experiencing our bodies oozing in and out to their surroundings. Deep listening, as a potentially transformative method of multi-directional and multi-species navigation, became our embodied strategy of mapping that moment in time. Part 7. Walking through London in the UK one afternoon earlier this week, looking for a spot to write this final part, I remember the pool I used to go to for evening swims. As I approach the pool and its cafe with the big windows facing a park, I notice a wall that hadn't been there before. Large syllables are mounted to it, forming the following sentence. If you write a story, This is where it takes place. Trusting that my body has taken me to the right place, I sit down at a table and I open my notebook. In 1999, American composer and performer Pauline Oliveros wrote Quantum Listening, a manifesto for listening as activism. I must admit, it is the only piece of writing by her that I have read, and only recently, so I am by no means knowledgeable about her extensive legacy. Since Oliveros and her sound meditations are of importance to many artists, some of them mentioned today, I would like to share a few of the ideas she articulates in this text. For Oliveros, deep listening was a lifelong practice. The more one listens, the more one hears. She writes, and I quote, "Deep listening is active. Listening shapes culture, locally and universally. Compared with reading and writing, relatively little attention is given to developing listening skills, or even to considering the nature of listening. Deep listening is exploring the relationships among any and all sounds, whether natural or technological, intended or unintended, real, remembered, or imaginary. Thought is included. Deep listening also includes the environmental and atmospheric context of sound. The perceiver and the perceived co-create through the listening effect. The skin listens too. Listeners near one another affect or influence one another with active listening." These 9 lines, collected from different paragraphs of Quantum Listening, show the scope of listening as a means to connect with and navigate the world, from the very near, our skins, our memories, the blood circling through our veins, to the universe and all it entails. Active listening and listening to listening is relational and, therefore, potentially transformative. It is multidirectional. The elements involved are subject to change. An eardrum, a porous membrane, is affected by a wave of sound, and in turn affects the sound while transmitting it. The responsiveness is mutual, due to vibration. According to Oliveros, the world is a complex matrix of vibrating energy, matter, and air, just as we are made of vibrations. If vibration connects us with all beings, it is in a way like water. According to hydrofeminism, water is what makes us fundamentally part of everything else. It sustains us, surrounds us, and connects us to the very local and the vastly global in many ways. Every body of water is different, materially, sensorially, culturally, and historically. Every body of water plays a part in a collective process of world-making. Some bodies more than others, which is the cause of much planetary harm and political damage. We have granted ourselves the seemingly solid center of it all for far too long now. From the overflowing of riverbanks and the flooding of plains to the rise of acidity in oceans and reservoirs and its social and ecological implications, we are complicit. What do we do with this knowledge? How could we act and react, taking less of center stage? From what and from whom who came before us can we learn? Listening more consciously and less selfishly, with our entire beings in attunement to other beings might be one of possible moves towards turning the tide. Thank you for being present here today, and thank you for listening. We invite you to stay in this space for a while longer, to write any of the thoughts you might have on a card, even if it's just one word, or to come up to us and talk to us. Thanks.